Hello and welcome to The Wrap. I'm Travis Fain, one of WRAL's state government reporters.
And I'm Will Doran, another state government reporter.
And we're going to get you caught up on the week that was in North Carolina politics, particularly with a focus on the General Assembly. But we're going to start at the state Supreme Court, which reheard a couple of big voting rights cases today. Will, I'll let you lay this out. It's the voter ID case. And also the redistricting case that had gone one way last year and probably going to go another way this year.
Yeah, both of these have big national attention, particularly the redistricting case, because North Carolina really has the potential to have a big impact on which party controls the U.S. House of Representatives based on how much leeway the Republican-led legislature is going to have to draw the congressional districts. We've got 14 seats in the U.S. House. The Republicans would like to have a map that gives them at least 10 of those 14 seats, even in a year when the voters split roughly 50-50. The current map, which was a court-ordered map after the lawmakers' preferred maps got ruled unconstitutional, is 7-7. That's what we currently have. But again, that was court-ordered. And if the court now goes and undoes its rulings and undoes the gerrymandering protections that last year's ruling put into place, we could expect to probably see the map stop being 7-7 for the 2024 elections and switch to 10-4, maybe 11-3, which obviously, you know, has huge political implications nationally at a time when the U.S. House is under Republican control, but only by a really slim majority right now, 5 seats. You know, North Carolina alone could double that, you know, that national lead that Republicans have.
Yeah, and the difference politically is we had a court, we elect our Supreme Court, and last year it was majority Democrat. This year, after the November elections, majority Republican. So, gee, I wonder if maybe the decision will switch sides here.
Well, you know, as they say, elections have consequences, and what we have heard from both sides is that it's the other side who's engaging in judicial politics, and their side's judges are the true arbiters of the law. You know, in all of these decisions, the rulings have come down, you know, completely along party lines. You know, when the Democrats were in charge, it was a party line ruling saying, you know, gerrymandering violates the state constitution. And then when the Republicans flipped control and decided to rehear the case, ostensibly to reverse that decision, it was a party line decision yet again to do that. So, you know, I think everyone who watched it expects, you know, the court to undo that decision, and it'll be along party lines again. You know, probably no big surprises there. But, you know, it's just another, you know, aspect of the politicization of the courts that we've seen in recent years, you know, just really kind of front and center here.
And the same dynamic on the voter ID case, which was also reheard this week.
Correct. Yes. So as people know, we tried to pass a voter ID law in 2013. That was ruled unconstitutional for racial discrimination. We tried again in 2018. That was also ruled unconstitutional for racial discrimination. That ruling came down just a few months ago, last December, again, under the previous Democratic majority court in a party line ruling. The decision to redo that after Republicans took control was again in a party line ruling. And, you know, it appears based on what we heard in the oral arguments this week that, you know, the court is definitely leaning towards undoing that ruling from last year, which could mean that we have voter ID for the 2024 elections, although that's not a complete 100% guarantee if that happens, because this is only one of three different lawsuits that are currently challenging some aspect of our voter ID laws. There's two in state court, one in federal court.
And the one in federal court obviously would not be impacted by this, what we've been talking about, the split between Republicans and Democrats on the state Supreme Court, because it's federal court.
Correct. Yeah. That is right. Good analysis, Travis.
Good news for the attorneys that have been involved in a decade's worth of voter ID court wrangling. That will probably continue one way or another.
You know, I think one of the safest jobs in North Carolina, the best job security you can have is a voting rights attorney, or for, you know, or an election law attorney for either side, because we just, you know, it's never-ending litigation over everything here.
Yeah, and I assume the Supreme Court did not give a timetable for when it'll rule in these cases.
No. We, you know, it typically takes a few months. Sometimes it can take over a year, but, you know, we'd probably expect to see these rulings, you know, before the end of the year or maybe early 2024.
Particularly since you and I can guess what the ruling will say and which judges will sign on. I mean, at this point, we've been around and around on these issues for years and years and years and years and years. It's not really a surprise.
No, and I mean, you know, watching the oral arguments, you know, in the gerrymandering case, it was Chief Justice Paul Newby who wrote the dissent for the Republican justices during the previous ruling, and he was the one who really dominated the questioning during those arguments. And then on the voter ID case, it was Justice Phil Berger Jr. who wrote the dissent in that case, and this week he was the one that, you know, in those arguments really dominated the questioning. So you can probably expect that, you know, whatever the new opinions will be will look a lot like the Republican dissents that got published last year.
Yeah. Moving on to Governor Roy Cooper's budget proposal came out this week. He basically is saying this is a big moment in history. We've got all this money, including new federal money that's going to continue to kind of come down the pike on infrastructure. We've got a budget surplus. We've had this huge population and jobs growth. We really need kind of historic investments, particularly in education. I wanted 18% raises for teachers on average over the next 2 years. Immediately rejected, Will, by the General Assembly because it was something like $4 billion more than they have already publicly said they're willing to spend in the first year of this coming budget.
Yeah, I don't think that people were too surprised that the legislature would reject Cooper's budget. They have never.
They always do.
Taken up his suggestions for the budget. But yeah, I mean, there were pretty stark numbers that he put in there. And, you know, part of that is because we do have such a big budget surplus, but you know, as you wrote, Travis, what we heard from Senator Berger, Speaker Moore was, you know, this is, I think their word was irresponsible budget. And, you know, they, for the whole time the Republicans have been in charge of the legislature, have been very focused on, you know, keeping costs under control. Obviously, they came into power, you know, right after the Great Recession when we had huge deficits.
Yeah, he wants to roll back some tax cuts. He wants to forego, I guess I should say, since they're in the future, some corporate tax cuts. We're on a glide path to go down to 0% in the corporate income tax by 2030, which is beyond even what businesses, at least as their will is expressed by the North Carolina Chamber, want. The North Carolina Chamber is happy at 2.5%, has told me so, has said so publicly. Republicans, though, have already passed a law that says we're going to go down to 0%. So Cooper would have foregone that and also would go back to a tiered system for personal income taxes. Right now, we're one. Everybody pays on the same rate. I think it's 4.75% going down to 3.99%. Cooper wants to continue the glide path to 3.99% for people making under $200,000 a year, but not for people making over 200. I spent a long time explaining that. None of it's going to happen. That's not going to pass the General Assembly. Also on teacher raises, so we mentioned the 18% over 2 years. For state employees, the governor proposed 8% over 2 years. Now, there's other money in there, too, but those are the across-the-board numbers. Phil Berger this week, the Senate leader, saying you probably won't see that much of a spread between across-the-board raise numbers for teachers and state employees. Doesn't want to kind of play them off of each other. And that's a little nugget, I guess, that people can look for, is that you would expect those numbers to be closer when they come out of the legislature.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that's what we've seen in some recent budgets, that they've tried to really kind of keep teachers and the rest of the state workforce more or less equal with some of the raises.
It's been a little over the mat. At times, they've concentrated more on teachers on the lower end of the scale. And we don't know. The teacher pay scale is kind of complicated. It's 25 different years. You step up every year. We'll see what they do. I at this point, am not willing to make any bets. Medicaid, though, that passed. And once again, we've talked about how, like, this fait accompli of Medicaid, you know, third item that we're talking about in a week, it's a multi-billion-dollar massive policy, passed the Senate with only two no votes from Senator Norm Sanderson and Senator Eddie Settle. That's a new name. He's in his first term. We should be passing the House next week, right, Will?
Should be. You know, there was this kind of closed-doors deal that got announced by some of the top leaders, what, 2 weeks ago at this point?
Two and a half weeks, something like that.
And, you know, I think everyone's kind of smart enough to see, like, okay, like, if all the top people say that this is what we're going to do, then, you know, we're not going to try to torpedo that. And, you know, that's coming from folks on the left who, you know, haven't been too loud about trying to change the parameters of the bill. And also, you know, a lot of the lawmakers on the right have, you know, kind of fallen in line as well, you know, with what leadership wants. So the big question to bring it back around to the budget, though, is, you know, by putting this big, you know, prize of Medicaid expansion in the budget for Governor Cooper, who has fought for this for years, you know, what else are Republicans thinking that they're going to be able to put into the budget to basically make Cooper swallow it and
right.
sign it anyways? And they've been pretty explicit about this. I mean, you know, this isn't me, you know, coming up with some, you know, like, scheme or conspiracy theory. I mean, we've heard them directly
the scheme,
say
the Republican leadership came up with the scheme, and well, actually, you know what? Probably Democrats came up with the scheme about 20 years ago, and it's just being applied to Medicaid now. So yeah, the budget will have to become law for Medicaid to become law expansion.
Yeah, so that is going to be, you know, one of the big things to watch when the House unveils the budget, which should be coming fairly soon towards the end
early
of this month.
Early April we're hearing on the House budget, although parts of it usually kind of roll out before then.
Yeah.
And the Senate may be done with their version of the budget after that in mid-May. We'll see. Critical race theory, the bill that passed, was it 2 years ago, I guess, in the governor veto, that limits how teachers can talk about race and sex in the classroom, concepts like systemic racism, oppression. That passed committee in the House. It's in House rules. I expect that'll move forward pretty quickly. Like we said, that's one that's passed before that the governor has vetoed. It says you can't promote, uses the word promote, concepts along the lines of saying that the United States is a racist country, or that anyone, quote, solely by the virtue of his or her race or sex should feel discomfort, guilt, or anguish. It's kind of a culture war bill, right? Well, I mean, you know, that's what this is.
Yeah, well, you know, it's written to target both sides, you know, saying, well, you can't, you know, teachers can't be promoting white supremacy either. It's like, you know,
yeah,
as
good.
Well,
definitely need to write
be,
that down. Yeah.
Right. You know, so that's kind of the way it's written. But, I think everyone sees that it's really targeted at, you know, these the critical race theory ideal, which, you know, is really, you know, in its classical sense is, you know, kind of a law school course or a grad school course. I don't think many K-12 schools are actually teaching critical race theory. And opponents of this say that it's really intended to just kind of scare teachers away from broaching any sort of topic around race. Of course, we have no idea how it'll be applied and, you know, how much teeth will this bill actually have if it gets filed, you know.
Yeah, because, I mean, the way the bill is written, it doesn't say, well, you can't talk about it at all. It says you can't promote it. And it says you have to give, I believe it's 30 days notice if the topic is going to be broached or if you're going to bring in a speaker who's going to touch on the topic. But there are some exceptions to that. And one of the exceptions is really interesting to me. Well, it was in there last time and I pointed out last time. So you can still talk about this stuff as long as it's impartial instruction. And I'll read you a quote from the bill. The impartial instruction, this is one of the exceptions, the impartial instruction on the historical oppression of a particular group of people based on race, ethnicity, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Why do we want teachers to only speak impartially about oppression? Like, why can't we be against that? Well, I texted John Torbett, State Representative John Torbett, that very question, because this is his bill. Did not hear back. So, I don't know. To the extent that you think that says something about the bill, I leave it to you. Gun bill. You wrote about this week. Gun bill passed the...
Yes, the pistol permit repeal and also carry guns in churches if the churches also have like a private school attached to them. That part of the bill is much less controversial. We've allowed concealed carry in all religious services. This applies to mosques, synagogues, and, you know, Buddhist temples, anything you can think of. We've allowed that since the 90s, but there's always been a carve out for, you know, if there's a private school attached to it, then, you know, no guns on school grounds. This bill would get rid of that rule. And, you know, supporters have pointed to the rise in, you know, hate crimes and mass shootings at mosques and synagogues and occasionally churches, you know, like the Charleston, South Carolina shooting a few years ago, the white supremacist attack at a church there. You know, so supporters say, you know, people are scared sometimes going to these religious services, and just because there's a school attached, they shouldn't be banned from bringing guns. Opponents say, well, you know, they could accidentally leave a gun behind in the bathroom or classroom. Kids find it when school comes back on Monday. Somebody hurts themselves. That's probably a more likely scenario than, you know, an act of terror happening. Regardless, as I said, that part really wasn't the controversial piece of the bill. The more controversial part was the pistol permits, which are a way for local sheriffs to approve who should or shouldn't have handguns. And that law dates back to the Jim Crow era. Republicans say that, you know, they are promoting a positive racial change by getting rid of this Jim Crow law. Democrats didn't really buy that excuse. One of their big concerns is that, and I think you've written about this, Travis, before, but basically the way that we prosecute domestic violence here in North Carolina is so vague that the federal background check system is actually banned from flagging those cases.
Yeah, it doesn't always pick it up in the NICS check, the national background check that you get when you buy a gun from a gun store. And so the question is, how much of a loophole are we allowing here by saying, oh, the NICS check will catch any problems. We don't need this redundant pistol this redundant pistol permit system where the sheriff has to sign off on you buying a handgun. We'll see. I'm sure this is one that the governor is going to veto again, or I kind of would expect, but I mean it.
We'll see. I mean, several Democrats voted for this in the House, and Republicans only need one of them to continue voting for it to override a veto. So
this is one that's going to get national attention, though. You would think that a Democratic governor, any kind of gun legislation, a veto is common. But I mean, the Cooper administration certainly does not discuss that kind of stuff with me.
No, they are always very tight-lipped. Even on bills like this that he's vetoed in the past, they won't say if he's going to veto again. And, you know, they could be trying to figure out, okay, do we want to put, you know, some of these, you know, because the Democrats who voted for it are all, you know, from rural-ish areas and, you know,
they might come home to bat the governor on this. We'll see. At the moment, the governor's got two bills that he's vetoed in the past on his desk. It's a hotel safety bill, one of them that helps hotel owners get people out if they don't pay or they're causing trouble. And the other one is the speaker's bill increasing the penalty on riots. We're taping this, I think, 3 o'clock or so on Thursday. I don't know if we'll see action on that this week. Also on gun violence, the governor created a new office kind of to prevent gun violence. I'm not entirely sure the parameters of everything it does, but one thing that it's going to do is a public awareness campaign on things like safe storage. That's slated to start in June, just to tell people, like, here's how state government works. I remember this public awareness campaign being discussed at a meeting of police chiefs that the governor and the attorney general participated in July of 2022. So this urgent public awareness campaign will begin approximately 1 year after I learned about it.
There you go, moving at the speed of government.
Speaking of the speed of government, there is a bill, and the governor also did an executive order this week so that fewer state jobs would require a 4-year degree. The State Office of Human Resources is also, it sounds like, going to take a pretty good look at what qualifications they ought to have in general for various jobs. We're in a workforce shortage. State agencies, a lot of them, above 20% vacancy rates. We're looking for ways to get more people to into these jobs. Scenic, the State Employees Association, a little concerned about this bill and this executive order because they see it as kind of a backdoor to, well, maybe we don't need to do such big raises if we widen the potential workforce. So Artis Watkins, the executive director of Scenic, all over this week and saying, no, I see it. So I don't know that that's the intention, but there is a concern there. The Board of Governors. We got some new members elected this week. Will, you've recognized some of these names that the Senate is putting on or back on the Board of Governors?
Yeah, well, you know, I think people will recognize former Senate Majority Leader Harry Brown got an appointment from his friends in the Senate now that he's retired. You know, see a lot of big names there. Actually, I'm going to bring it back around to the top of the podcast here with the voter ID thing. I see Joel Ford's name on there. He is a Democrat
who
is on the Board of Governors. And I believe this is still the case. I know at one point he was the only Democrat on the Board of Governors.
I believe he is the only registered Democrat on the Board of Governors and was known for voting with Republicans from time to time in the Senate. Disappointed some of his colleagues on that and made some of his Republican colleagues happy.
Exactly. And one of the bills that he voted on was voter ID, one of very few Democrats and specifically Black Democrats to vote for voter ID. Republicans have pointed to that as proof that the court's wrong and their law is not racially discriminatory. Why would a Black Democrat vote for something that's racially discriminatory? The opponents have said that it was part of a deal that Ford only voted for that bill, you know, to get himself a seat on the Board of Governors, since he knew that he had lost his primary for the legislature. He, of course, very much denies that. Republicans have denied it, but he's getting reappointed here. No. So however it happened, you know, people are clearly happy with him on the board.
So in addition to former Senators Brown and Ford, we have Martin Holton III, Temple Sloan III, Haywood White III, Michael Williford. Those are the six appointees. Brown and White are the new members. The rest are reappointments. There were some diversity concerns. I mean, this is five old white guys and Joel Ford, which is not unusual for the Board of Governors. Senator Gladys Robinson expressing some of those concerns. She's a former Board of Governors member herself. You know, as I noted on Twitter, three of the six appointees have the third in their name. You can decide whether that's indicative of anything. The House will also appoint Board of Governors members. That is coming soon. Their slate as early as next week. A bill cleared the Senate this week, increasing the penalties for fentanyl. And, I mean, obviously the opioid epidemic continues, and this boosts the penalties against drug dealers, as I understand it. I don't know chapter and verse on that one. I do know that the North Carolina Survivors Union is against it, basically saying, hey, we can't punish our way out of the overdose crisis. Also passing the Senate this week, an increase in penalties on substation attacks. This is from, when was it, Will, that someone shot up the substation in Moore County?
I think that was December, right? The county, or large parts of the county at least, were without power for a long time as, you know, they struggled to get things back up and running. I do this attack and still haven't figured out who did it.
Yeah, and I think the bill is to try to make sure there's not a loophole that lets people get off with lower state penalties if something like this happens. We want to make it clear, hey, you know, you can't do that. Bill got two amendments this week, one to include cyber attacks as well as physical attacks, another to add the right to sue. So if you own the substation and it gets damaged, you can sue. And it lifts the cap on punitive damages, so you can get more money back from the person you're suing. So just another kind of a way to tell people this is extremely serious. Bill is on its way to the House. Real quick in politics, Wesley Harris, a member of the House. Is he an economist?
I believe so, yeah.
I feel like I've heard him say that before. He's running for treasurer. Have you heard anyone else who's announced for treasurer? I'm not sure I have. Wesley Harris is a Democrat, maybe I should mention.
He is, yeah. He's a Democrat from Charlotte, state lawmaker. You know, obviously, current treasurer is Republican Dale Falwell, who I don't believe has made an official announcement yet.
No, and is considering running for governor and has been for some time. Where that stands, I don't know. If you're running for state treasurer and we didn't mention you, we're sorry. It's not 2024 yet.
Let us know.
Real quick, I'll mention that the technical corrections bill for the 2022 budget passed the Senate Wednesday. Must not be too controversial because it passed 46-0, but it emerged like the day before in committee, and I didn't even realize. Yeah, technical correction bills drive me nuts because they have all this different stuff in it. This is like 12, 14 pages, tens and tens, hundreds of millions of dollars. Who knows what's in it, and it just pops up. But that is passed the Senate. We'll head over to the House. The Guru contract, that's this entity that makes some sort of software that can track student learning and is meant to be used to track pandemic learning loss. That contract is in this technical corrections bill. There's also $59 million for UNC's cancer research, technical revisions to various spending on infrastructure projects, a bunch of grant deadlines. My favorite one, Will, $30 a year correction to DA salaries. Apparently, when they list all the salaries for various entities in the state budget and they miss DAs by $30, got that wrong. So that gets its correction. They're going to get a $30 a year raise.
Hey, you know, you can buy a couple nicer lunches with that extra $30.
That's right. There's also an increase in the bill, the technical corrections bill, which is House Bill 2, by the way, in confidentiality on megasite development. I don't fully understand that, but
we've had a lot of action with our megasites recently, you know, projects like VinFast and things like that. So,
yeah, so much so that I don't think we have any more megasites left. In the governor's budget, he proposed $100 million to develop new megasites. We may have one left. I'm not sure. I'm not a megasite expert. But I do know the governor wants $100 million in order to boost that.
All right, well, what else is going on?
I'll run through some random bills here that I just happened to see filed this week or recently. There's an economic development bill that's filed in the House and the Senate. That's H-346 in the House and S-296 in the Senate. Usually if it's filed both places, a lot of times it's a mover. There's a bill, H-349, to protect firefighters from PFAS. That's the stuff that has all sorts of ill health effects, and it gets used in firefighting foam. I have not read the bill, but that's kind of an annual debate of how much protection we're going to give firefighters. Deb Butler's got a bill to fully repeal House Bill 2. That's House Bill 356, Deb Butler's bill. I haven't looked at it, but I know, Will, there's always been some controversy about how far we went and did we go far enough in repealing House Bill 2, the bathroom bill.
Sure. Well, and, you know, a lot of the LGBTQ parts of that are gone, obviously. But what's still in effect is this rule banning cities from doing things like raising the minimum wage in their locality. And, you know, kind of just for cities and counties not allowed to, you know, sort of pass their own rules on big issues like that. I mean, you know, we saw actually a debate like that on, in the House this week on, you know,
local control, what they can and can't do.
Right, can't ban natural gas stoves, you know, kind of leaning into that national debate.
Yeah. Did it pass the House this week on you can't, basically saying counties and cities can't tell you can't put a natural gas stove or heat pump or water heater into a new construction.
Yeah.
Even though we don't know, Asheville, maybe we'll do that one day, but we don't know of any county or city who's actually actively looking to ban that. But like you said, it's an industry bill.
Right. But, you know, there's just this kind of, you know, desire to not let the cities, which are obviously mostly run by Democrats, you know, get out ahead of the rest of the state with various rules for things that they want to do.
Yep. House Bill 358 from Kelly Alexander, $3.5 million would be available for security upgrades to lawmakers' homes, and it would also forbid posting addresses, personal information, stuff like that. I don't know that that bill is a goer, but I did learn today that Representative Alexander's home was firebombed when he was 17 years old. His father was head of the state NAACP. So I suspect that that's part of the place where that's coming from. Last one I'll mention, House Bill 359 from Charles Miller. It's a basically, it says that if you're a passenger in a vehicle that's in an accident, you have to give your name, age, or date of birth and phone number, you know, identifying information to the officer who responds. Don't know if that one will move forward, but it did catch my eye. What are we doing next week, Will?
Oh, well, you know, it's going to be a slow week. No, I'm lying. This has really been a very busy session, and we're continuing that. Sports betting is going to be up first thing on Tuesday. You know, Mondays are always, you know, pretty much nothing going on, but Tuesdays we're kicking things off with the sports betting bill, which has resurrected after failing by just one vote in the House last year, and seems to have both bipartisan support and bipartisan opposition. You know, so many things you hear, oh, this came down along a party line vote. This is one of the rare bills that that isn't party lines. It's got, you know, arguments on both sides, for and against.
Yeah, neither the House nor Senate taking votes on the floor on Monday, I'll mention. Senate says likely none Wednesday or Thursday, so it sounds like only Tuesday floor votes for the Senate. The House has typically been doing its floor votes, I think, mostly on Wednesdays. The Senate says it's catching up on bill drafting, so after it does the stuff that moved through rules Thursday, today while we're recording this, it will probably be done on the floor for the week. And the House won't have any floor votes till Wednesday, which I may have already said. I think that's all I've got.
Yeah, you know, we'll see what else comes up, but it's, I mean, just continuing at a breakneck pace here, and, you know, eventually we're going to have a budget to talk about too, in addition to all these bills that are going on.
That's right. We will try to keep you caught up next week on The Wrap.